Date number three on August 16th, 2005, the oral history interview with Professor Harold Shoaib.
So what I was going to do was to make, I knew I was going to do this, I was going to make as complete a collection of storytelling, and that includes narratives, includes histories, poems, epics. Everybody told me epics don't exist in South Africa, but I was going to see. And I was going to comb through the Transkei and to a certain extent the Ciskei, these two Xhosa areas, and then move up to Zululand and do the same thing in KwaZulu, and then time, as I said, if time allowed, to go to Swaziland and Zimbabwe. So I did meet some people in Umtata, and they were helpful to me. But I was staying in a hotel, and the government then decided they did not want me to do research, the kind of research I had intended to do, where I would deal with African people. They said, go to the libraries and do your research in the research libraries. And I was adamant, and I said, no. I mean, you had agreed that you would allow me to do this. So I had to cool my heels for 2 weeks, and then they finally relented and said I could do that. I think I have a sense, as I'll talk later on, the third time I went back, I had a sense that they were watching me, as I think they did everybody from outside the country. So what I did was, I had to get down to the southern part of the country, where and then I wanted to work my way up, and I had no car. I was going to walk. And so the buses were segregated in South Africa. But in the Transkei, you know, whites never take the bus, it appeared, and so they allowed me to go on the bus, but not very happily. But there was no way I could get down there otherwise. So I got down there, and I started walking. And people were very reticent to have anything to do with me. Okay. I was in these remote areas, some of them mountainous, not far from the Indian Ocean. And it didn't, my experience was that no matter how remote I got in South Africa, everybody would, in one way or another, have had an unsatisfactory relationship with a white person, either face-to-face in the mines or the sugar plantations or something, or a relative of theirs. So here was this white guy coming along and trying to get himself invited to some of the most precious things, you know, that the people have, and that's their oral traditions. And I didn't want them to create oral traditions just for me. I wanted to be invited to actual oral storytelling performances, and I just wanted to recede into the background and listen. And if they allowed me, tape it, and if they allowed me, to photograph it. So that's the way I started. And initially, people would have nothing to do with me. And people in South Africa, Xhosa, Zulu, do not live in villages. Their homes are scattered, so you have one homestead, maybe made up of five houses or something, and then you might have to travel a mile to go to another, and so forth. And so if one person was not going to have anything to do with me, I would simply start walking. Well, the nice thing was, it was beautiful country. It was a beautiful countryside. I loved walking. I love walking anyway. So
you must have been in good physical
shape. I was in good shape. I had everything I had, I had in a pack. That was it. My big problem was batteries. These your tape recorders take these size D batteries, which are these flashlight batteries. Man, alive. And on a good day, I found, you would use up five batteries. And so my problem always, forever, was batteries. I would have people send batteries to villages ahead of me so that I would have them. You know, alkaline batteries, because these regular batteries, these Ever-Readies that they sell in the shops up in the mountains, they wouldn't work at all. They just weren't strong enough. So that was a problem. And then tapes, I jam my pack with tapes, and I had borrowed a motion picture camera from down on the second floor here from the people who operate this, tape recorders and so forth down there. And I stopped, I remember, at 42nd Street Photo in New York on my way out and picked up a cheap camera. I didn't know that cameras were going to be that important to me. A cheap, you know, slide camera. So I had all this stuff with me. And I was wearing shorts and had a pair of trousers packed in there. That was about it. Some changes of underwear. And so I start walking. And nothing is happening. And then I met a number of people who were doctors, traditional doctors. We call them witch doctors, but I learned very quickly that that's a very unfair term. And they weren't, by and large, they weren't afraid of me at all. And so I started hearing stories from them. And then when other people saw that they were telling me stories, then things began to soften a bit. There's no question but that I had a stultifying effect on the story, my presence there. I knew this because, you know, later on, when people got to know me and they were more accepting of me, the stories got richer and more full-bodied. It was just wonderful. I would hear stories, and I would stick around in an area until I had no problem with time. I would stay as long as, a week or longer, as long as the storytelling traditions were, still pretty rich. And then I would pick up and go. I would always ask if I could tape it, and if they allowed me to, I would tape it. I never taped anything that they did not allow me to tape. I never took pictures unless they allowed me to take pictures. And many of the people asked me to, they told me their names, but they asked me to use pseudonyms because they were so worried about the government. And so I did that. And then it was just magic. Things started happening. And I was getting more, more relaxed. My language was improving. I still remember the first time I ever heard a story in Xhosa. I thought I had learned the wrong language. It just washed over me like a flood because I had studied a literary language, and this was all oral. So it took me about really 6 months really to get relaxed. I could get along, and I could hear the stories and make out most of the stories. I was still, my mind was picking up the things and so forth, but it was coming. And nobody, as I said, spoke English. Or Afrikaans, for that matter. I studied Afrikaans on my own. And the stories were becoming more and more magnificent. And a couple of wonderful things happened. I met, further north among the Mponamise people, I met a man, and actually Professor Jordan had known him in his youth. He was then an elderly man, Mdukisa Chibashe was his name, and he was a bard, a poet, official poet for a king. And he was in sort of retirement now, and there was a new king, but he still went to the palace, to the royal place and royal residence and created poetry for the king. And I was interested in this, and so he sort of apprenticed me to him, and I stayed with him for quite some time. He told me the history of the Mponamise, I taped that, and a lot of other things, but most exciting and most dramatic were the scenes in the court of the king when he created these poems, and there would be 400 people there, and the king would be sitting there and acting as if he wasn't involved in what was happening, but of course he was. And the king was somebody that this poet did not have much respect for because he felt he was in power because of Praetoria. And so his poetry was laced with irony that could not have escaped the king. But the poet, just like in medieval times in Europe, the poet was very important. He represented the people to the king. And therefore, he maintained his independence from the king. So it was wonderful. And so I worked with him, and I was becoming, again, more and more confident, and I just continued to walk. Sometimes I would get a lift with some missionaries, and they would take me up into, for example, in the foothills of the Drakensberg Mountains, where the Hlubi people live, who are closest speaking people. Just to show you my facility with language, I got off from this. These missionaries gave me a lift. These two guys gave me a lift up in the mountains. I got off and I walked to a place, and some women, Hlubi women, came to me and said, "How did you get here?" And what I wanted to say in Xhosa was, I got a ride with some missionaries, and what I actually said was, I rode some missionaries, and learned very quickly that the word ride has sexual connotations. in Kosa, and so from then on, whenever I went back to this area, it was always nudge, nudge, here comes a guy who rides missionaries. And but again, it was a wonderful way to break the ice. And when I would make mistakes with the language, the people would laugh at me, and then they would gather around and teach me. So, because they knew how important it was to me. Early on, the people would say, yeah, you can come to this storytelling session, but you have got to tell a story from your own tradition. And I still remember the first time I ever heard told Jack and the Beanstalk in Xhosa, and it was a disaster. And again, the people gathered around me and told me what I was doing wrong. It was the best thing that could ever have happened to me, because it was taking me really into the skin of these stories. And so it was good. And always different. I never knew what was going to happen. Each area that I, each time I moved on, I never knew what was going to happen. But my confidence increased, and I was ready to be disappointed. And then, an echo from the United States. This was a time when Muhammad Ali, the United States had taken away his heavyweight championship because he was opposed to the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
And it seemed to me, this is an overstatement, but it seemed to me that no matter how remote in South Africa I got, it seemed that on the wall of every house there was a picture of Muhammad Ali. I think that probably in his day he was probably the best known person on earth. And they knew his story, that here was a black man who was defying a whole white people in the interest of something that he believed in. And they respected that. And somehow a bit of that rubbed off on me. I was from the United States. I can't be all that bad. I was from Muhammad Ali's land. And I spoke the language. I was getting better at it. I didn't have a car. I was the most vulnerable person on earth. So I certainly could not be any kind of a harm to anybody. So I think all these things played into my played into my desires. And then as time went on, I think part of my confidence also in the language helped as well. And so I was combing. I was moving through all these different areas. I remember where I was when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I remember where I was when Crispin Barnard did the first heart transplant.
Yes.
In Cape Town. I was working among the Bomvana people. I remember hearing that on my little Sony radio thing early in the morning as I was setting out. So all kinds of things were happening, that were kind of exciting and kind of distressing. Just a note, I was at a play in London when Robert Kennedy was assassinated. They announced it during the play. And then to go back to John Kennedy, I remember where I was in Valparaiso University on the day that he was assassinated. See, these are become sort of psychological markings. Anyway, so I'm collecting the stories, and I'm getting more confident, and I move through the Transkei and feel that I have a pretty good collection. The most wonderful thing that happened to me then, and that probably one of the most wonderful things that ever happened in my life, was one day in the Transkei, I was walking, I was going to a beer party overlooking the Indian Ocean. I had been told that there would be storytellers there. So I'm by myself at dusk. I've been living, by the way, I lived in a tent. I had a pup tent. And the people, I used it a couple of times, and then the people would never allow me to do that. Even if they weren't going to invite me to storytelling sessions, if they would see me out there fumbling with this tent, they would say, this is ridiculous. You're going to come and sleep in our home. And under apartheid, it was against the law for a white person to stay in a black person's home all night. And what the government would have done is they would have kicked me out of the country. But these people could have been in deep trouble. But they wouldn't hear of this. And so I gave the pup tent away, ultimately. And while on the subject, I also had two cans of beans. And I didn't know anything about cooking, but in the evening I would build a fire and look like I was, gonna do these beans. And again, the people would come out and say, no, you're not gonna do this. You're gonna dine with us. And this from people who had nothing. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, he electrified the world with this sense of forgiveness that he had 27 years in prison, and yet he had this wonderful sense of forgiveness, and it didn't surprise me at all. He was a Xhosa, and I knew the the humanism that runs through Xhosa tradition, and had participated in that. So the people were just wonderful. Even if they weren't going to invite me to storytelling sessions, They would not allow a stranger to go by their home without offering them hospitality. It was simply built in. They were just wonderful. Anyway, so I'm walking along this path. It's dusk. I'm carrying my tape recorder. And a woman comes along. I'd never met her before. Tall, imperious woman, around 50 years old, I think. She introduced herself, said she understood I was interested in stories. Would I like to hear a story from her? Well, I generally like to attend actual storytelling sessions, but we sat down alongside the path. I turned my tape recorder on, and she told a story that took an hour to tell. Not a bunch of little stories idly linked together, but one glorious, unified story. From then on, wherever that woman was, I was there, wanting to collect a repertory of stories from her, and I did collect a repertory of stories, including a story that was 3 hours long. And wow. I knew now that I was in the neighborhood of epic. Even though people told me there was no such thing as an epic, I felt that this woman had it within her. Anyway, she was really very important to me. Nongenile Masitatu Zenani was her name. She was the greatest storyteller I ever met. And I published a book, the UW Press, called The World and the Word, by her, which contains a number of the stories that she had created. She didn't read, but I sent this to her, and or to her family anyway, and also sent her pictures that I had taken of her. She was an absolutely magnificent storyteller, one of Africa's greatest, I think.
Was she absolutely thrilled with the book?
Yeah. Now I'm trying to remember if I sent her articles that I had written about her, which she was very excited about, and I'm trying to remember if she was still alive when I sent the book over. She died in 1985. What's the copyright date of that? That's vague in my memory now.
'92.
Yeah, so she didn't see it, but her family saw it. Anyway, she was just glorious, and so she was very much in my mind. She would have been worth the whole trip. Okay, and then I move further north to KwaZulu and work in Zululand, and I had the same thing happen. Takes a while, and then after a while, stories start coming, and I again met various, I worked with hundreds of storytellers. Some of them are very memorable, and others are, sort of everyday storytellers. In South Africa, they don't have, the Xhosa, the Zulu, do not have professional storytellers. Everybody's a storyteller. It's a very egalitarian kind of a profession. And so what comes out of that is that, most people are sort of, okay, they can tell a story, but they're not Homeric. But then among them, these wonderful Homeric storytellers sort of blossom.
Uh-huh.
And so I worked with everybody. I mean, I have stories that are run-of-the-mill stories, and then other storytellers who are just magnificent. I taped all of that. I have over 9,000 stories now on tapes and films, and they're all in a bank vault in town. I was very worried that these were these old cellulose tapes, that they would begin to disintegrate, and
yes,
in fact, that's happening. And just as a footnote here, the University of Wisconsin Memorial Library has just finished a 2-year project of digitizing all of my tapes. So they are now preserved. And they are now going to do the same thing with my slides and my motion pictures. I took motion pictures with a Super 8mm camera. Their video stuff was available, but it was so cumbersome that there's no way I could ever have carried that with me. And so, the first time I did research, I used a Super 8mm that I borrowed, as I told you, from this building, and it was it was silent. There were no sound. But,
uh-huh.
But after that, when I knew how important the body is and the voice is during performance, then I invested in a very good still camera and also motion picture camera. Anyway, so I work among the Zulu. And things went very well there. And then I went into Swaziland and worked among the Swati people and collected materials there. And then went to the southern part of Zimbabwe and worked among the Ndebele peoples.
And this is all just on
this
trip?
This 1 year, right. This is this first year. I had, each time I went, the university of Wisconsin was very generous about giving me time off, and so was my department. But I had to go into a national competition for fellowships. So over the years, I've had a Guggenheim, I've had a Rockefeller, I've had a number of National Endowment for the Humanities grants, Social Science Research Council, Ford Foundation. So I have I've received grants from a variety of different sources for my research. Okay, so when that was over, that first year, this was very, very exciting for me. I came back here, and I was so pleased. I had tons of material, more than I would ever need for my PhD dissertation. I had to get it I had to translate it and so forth. And when I came back, Professor Jordan had been diagnosed with lung cancer. And so this must have been, 67, 68. I think I came back in 68 then. So I must have been back here in 69. And I was at his house. I went out to his house every day, lived out on the west side, and he listened to tapes, and he was very helpful to me in helping me, especially with some of the more arcane aspects of the oral language. I took notes copiously. And one day while I was visiting him, he collapsed, and I was rushed to the telephone, and he told me weakly, just call a taxi, he said. And so I called a taxi, and we took him to his doctor, and the doctor put him in the hospital, and he was diagnosed with lung cancer. I was a smoker, by the way, at that time.
Oh.
And I remember visiting him in the hospital every day. He was so excited. I would take my tape recorder, and he would listen to talk to me about it. And I would be, and that in those days, it was still, they had smoking areas in the hospital, and I'd be out in the hall smoking, and the doctor, who ultimately became my doctor, came out once and told me, "What are you doing out here smoking?" He said, "That man is dying because of he was a smoker." And I just, cold turkey, I just quit overnight. No more smoking.
Really?
Yeah, I just quit. Anyway, so this was really tragic. I was losing Professor Jordan. He was so excited about the materials. He was still teaching me right up until the end. And then he died. And again, to show you what apartheid South Africa is, his body could not be taken back to South Africa. He's buried here in Madison. And also to show you what this government was like, within a couple of days after his death, the immigration people kicked his wife out of this country because she had no reason for being here anymore. His family, wife and family. But fortunately, Kassenmeier was the representative at that time, and he got an act of Congress. She's still living in Michigan, actually, to this day. She goes to South Africa, but her home is still here.
So the immigration would kick her out,
because
she couldn't go back to South Africa?
Well, it wasn't clear whether she could go back. Her husband could not go back, but whether she could. But it was just very ugly. But again, this was mainly due to Crawford Young. He got a hold of Kassenmeier, and it was just magic. They did an act of Congress. And by the way, another interesting thing, her son, Paolo Jordan, was actively engaged in the anti-war movement in this country, and the immigration people kicked him out and would not let him back. So when he got married, he had to marry in Canada so that his family could go up to his wedding in Canada. He, by the way, is a member of the cabinet. Paolo Jordan, he was a member of Mandela's cabinet, and he's still a member of Mbeki's cabinet. Yes.
Wonderful.
It's really interesting. Paolo Jordan. Yeah, he's a very important figure now in free South Africa.
Are you in touch with him?
Yeah. In fact, a number of times. He's asked me to do a few things for him with the oral traditions a couple of times. And I've been I haven't been in contact with him for a while, but we are in contact from time to time. And I'm regularly in contact with his wife. She, a couple of months ago, I had a big parcel in the mail. And she had had a portrait done of A.C. Jordan as a younger person by a Michigan artist who used photographs to do this. And she sent it to me as a gift, a big portrait. Very happy about that.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, so I came back, did my PhD. Again, there was still all this, you know, this is when the anti-war movement was still very big here. And so I picked up on, got back involved in politics in this country, and and Professor Jordan died before I could finish my dissertation. So before he died, he asked Jan van Sida if he would work with me to complete the dissertation. So so I had two really magnificent figures help me with my work with me in my dissertation, Jordan and Van Sina. And I became, I've always been an admirer of Jan van Sina. When I finished my PhD, I still remember this. I had no idea what I was going to do, because, and it wasn't, there weren't many possibilities for teaching, you know, African oral tradition in this country. But Crawford Young, who was then the chair of African Studies, and who was still, at that time, this department was still pretty close to African Studies. We weren't totally on our own yet. There was a Paisans, I still remember it, over on University Avenue. It's gone now. It's where
University Square.
This side of University Square, where the theater.
It's where the Vilas Hall.
Vilas Hall. And he took
Paisans
me.
Paisans being a pizza parlor.
That's right. And he took me to Paisans, and offered me a job.
He did.
Yeah. It doesn't happen that often, you know, where you get your PhD. So I was very thrilled, and he pretty much gave me carte blanche as to what I wanted to teach, literature, oral traditions, so forth. It was very important to me. I was walking on a cloud, because, you know, first of all, I had fallen in love with this university, and second, to be a part of this department, which was still, you know, in its early years, to be a part of the shaping of that excited me very much.
So you got your PhD in about 1969,
I think, and went on the faculty. Then I had, what I had was, I had a year postdoc grant to work on my tapes and so forth. And then so I went on the faculty, it must have been about 1970, 71. But I also knew that what, you know, what I really wanted to do here, you know, I saw my career breaking into two parts. The first part, I would actively collect materials, and the second part, I would write materials about. So I was still anxious to go to South Africa, but to do my research. But you know, this university is very—that's very important to the university. You know, original research.
Yes.
And there was a lot of that in this department. We were all over the place. You know, in Africa doing research. So a couple years later, then I went back to South Africa, and a party still very much, you know, in control there.
And at which point you're an assistant professor?
An assistant professor. I had my first book was published by Oxford University Press. I think that, I think I was on my way to Africa or on my way back. I stopped off at Oxford and worked with the editors and so forth on it. It was my doctoral dissertation, which was prepared in book form, the Xhosa Itsomi, it's called. And worked with some of the same storytellers, Mazitatu Zenani again, but worked with new storytellers and so forth. This second time, it was a more intense time. I pretty much knew the lay of the land now, so I did most of it among the Xhosa and the Zulu, because there was an awful lot of work that I wanted to do there, and so it was a fine tuning of what I had done. And then by now it was Old Home Week. You know, I had passed into the folklore myself. So I had no trouble being invited to storytelling sessions now. None of that trouble. I continued to walk. I never owned a car, by the way. When I was in Uganda, I had part ownership in a Volkswagen. That's the only time I ever had a car, and had a part ownership in a boat on Lake Albert in Uganda too, which a missionary sank once while he was out fishing, I remember. But I've never owned a car in this country, and never used one in South Africa. But again, I would get lifts from time to time. A rather dramatic one I'll tell you about in a little while. So again, the second time, made a collection, very exciting, an awful lot of photography this time. People were not, you know, were not reticent about that. And I did an awful lot of work with her the second time, Masitatu Zenani. came back, taught a couple of years, and went back again. Somewhere in all of this, I'm becoming an associate professor. I can't remember exactly when that was. The third time I went back, this was an extraordinary time in many respects. Around 75, 74, 75, 76 in that area. Because what I did was I had a research project, and then I also got a Fulbright lectureship at the University, National University of Lesotho in Roma. Sort of back to back. By this time, South Africa is in upheaval. The African areas are more and more dangerous for whites. I went everywhere, by the way. Never once, when I was in South Africa, I was figured, let them do to me what they want. I went wherever I went. If I wanted to go to Soweto, the African township 15 miles outside Johannesburg, which is very chancy, the government, it wasn't clear exactly. There were 350 apartheid laws. You didn't know whether you were breaking a law or not. I went to Soweto regularly. And I met a number of young revolutionaries. I remember the second time I was in South Africa, I had gone to Soweto, and they listened to some of my tapes, and they poo-pooed this. They said, look, where are there...
...of tape three of Professor Harold Scheub on August 16th, 2005.
Sorry I'm bouncing around a little bit, but to go back to the second time that I was there, things... You know, I didn't just do research, in collecting traditions. I also did research on apartheid. I went everywhere in South Africa. I went to all the parts of South Africa. I really wanted to understand. I went to Braaiplaas, these Braaiplaas, which are barbecues in Afrikaans, where white people would be there. I wanted to hear what they had to say, and they really collared me. They wanted to talk to me. They wanted to teach me about what South Africa really is. They couldn't teach me anything. You know, I knew more about South Africa than they did.
Did they know what you were doing?
Yes, and when I would try to tell them about these magnificent works that I was collecting, they didn't want to hear about this. It became very clear to me that many of these whites needed Africans in these positions of their perceived inferiority. The minute they would see these Africans as having these magnificent civilizations, it would put a lie to everything that they argued, and therefore the whole edifice of apartheid.
Harold, I have to ask, were these just Afrikaans, or were they, when you refer to whites, does this include those of British descent?
And that's very important. It's British as well. About two-thirds of the white population were Afrikaners, one-third British, but the British would often, this is, now I realize that this is oversimplified, but often what would happen is the British would say to you that they're not as racist as these Afrikaners are about the Africans, but the British participated in this 100%, and they did very, very well by apartheid. So there's no question in my mind that by and large, the British were as actively engaged in apartheid as the Afrikaners were.
Interesting.
No question in my mind. There's no question, but there were white Afrikaners and there were white British who were opposed, many of whom died because of this, many of whom went to jail because of this. I do not want in any way to suggest that there were not whites who were against apartheid and who actively participated in the anti-apartheid movement. This includes churches and synagogues also. But there were also churches like the Dutch Reformed Church, which right up until the very end, until the late 1980s, were in their faith, they built in this idea that Africans were meant to be hewers of water and drawers of water and hewers of wood. Uh-huh. The Bible says that they changed that only very late. That idea. But the anti-apartheid movement among the whites was minuscule. The blacks, it was by this time, in the early 70s, becoming enormous. So here's an interesting thing. So I meet these young African revolutionaries in Soweto, there would be storytelling sessions, poetry sessions, all kinds of things. But it just was a wonderful experience for me. And they said to me, look, these tapes, you know, they really don't have any relevance. When I went back to the rural countryside, I told the storytellers this. And to a person, they told me, look, how do you think we've endured 350 years of apartheid? They said it's the truths that are embodied in these stories that helped us to survive. So they said these stories were here long before the whites came. They'll be here long after the whites are gone. And so their argument was that this is the stuff, this is the foundation on which, you know, our civilizations are built. Okay, so the third time I go back, mid-70s now, I mean, things are really in upheaval, especially in these urban ghettos. And I went to Guguletu outside Cape Town, I went to Langa Township outside Cape Town, I went to all of these places. So I'm in Soweto, and it's late May, I arrive, and something is really going to happen in June. And I'm very keen to at least witness this. It's a real problem for me because when I first arrived in South Africa, I always felt the government was watching me carefully. And so I have to confess to you, Bob, this is one of the, maybe it's not an unscholarly thing that I did because I fooled around with dates on my tapes. Mazi Tatu knew what was going on. I was working with her. This third time I worked a lot with her. I met a girl whose name was Tembeka, a Zulu girl, at one of these storytelling sessions. And she's the one who first alerted me to something that was going to happen in mid-June. And so I went to start working in early June of 76. And a friend of mine from Johannesburg was going to come way the heck out to the Transkei, pick me up and take me back to Johannesburg so that I could be witness what was going to happen. So I worked it out with Mazi Tatu. I said, okay, look, you know, you're going to tell me stories and I'm going to date these different dates in order so it'll look like an unbroken continuity in case the government ever wants to give me hell about this. And these people were doing this just, it was wonderful that they were doing this for me. We had become pretty good friends. So they picked me up way out in the remote area of the Transkei. We go into Johannesburg. It's the evening of the 15th, and everything is to happen on the 16th. And so I go to Johannesburg, to Soweto. I know people there. It's a very exciting time, and it's no place for a white person to be because it was really liquid anger. And the next day, these kids, and they're young kids, many of them high school kids, went out into the streets of Johannesburg. Hundreds in their thousands. I remember Tembeka going out into this. I lost contact with her. I don't know what happened. And they started marching down the streets of Soweto and into Johannesburg, 15 miles away. They're marching down the street. Huge numbers. No weapons. They did have sticks and so forth. And the government met them, and it was awful. I mean, the government had these vehicles that they called hippos because they looked like hippopotamuses. You know, uh-huh. They were armed vehicles. They had them all over the place. And I was there. I stayed for 2 days, and then I got back. I had to go back again to, you know, resume my work. But I was there during this period when it started, and I was also in downtown Johannesburg when I saw them moving into Johannesburg, and then the police moved in on them. And then what happened was, it was magic. All over South Africa, young kids went out into the streets. The ostensible reason was that the government was going to force them to learn Afrikaans in the schools. They had to learn Afrikaans as well as English. Up until then, the kids were learning English. Afrikaans, they figured, the children said, is a language of oppression. And so the ostensible reason that triggered this response, but of course it's the whole 350 years of history that's doing this, propelled these kids out into the streets to do something, as many of them said, that their parents did not dare to do. And mind you, that's unfair to their parents because their parents had been fighting against this as well. So all these kids are out there. Over this next year, by a conservative estimate, 1,000 kids would be killed. It was on this, the newspapers of the world for the, if the, you know, the world, really did not pay much attention to. You know, we, in this country, we were interested in South Africa because of its strategic location under communism. You know, it was a very important to us, and so we didn't want to rock the boat. We officially were against apartheid, but we didn't do much about apartheid. And these kids were doing it. No weapons, nothing. And many of them died. Many of them were taken to concentration camps. We don't know to this day, you know, what happened. And so it was electrifying. It was it went on throughout June. And I think it was June 16th. I think that's the right date. And so I went back and I did my research. And then, as I said, the next year I went to, I was in Roma in Lesotho teaching. I'll come back to Masitato in a minute because it's very important for this research project. But just let me finish the political thing here. Steve Biko was a young, charismatic leader. Mm-hmm. And they Cry Freedom. The movie was made about him. Yeah. His friend was he was the editor of the East London Post Dispatch. The whites called it the East London Disgrace because it was anti-apartheid. Steve Biko was a brilliant person, and he believed in what he was trying to do was to counter some of the whites' arguments about African civilization and the idea that Africans had nothing to be ashamed of, that they had these great civilizations and so forth. And he had an enormous impact, and probably the police thought had an impact on these young people who went out into the streets in June. So September, and in fact, there's a song, a very famous song written about this, called Biko by, I lost their name for a moment, I'll think of it. Anyway, I think it's September 77 that the police caught him. You know, he was like, remember they called Nelson Mandela the Black Pimpernel because he couldn't get a hold of him. They finally caught him and put him in jail for life. They finally caught Biko. I think he was going to Cape Town, along from King Williamstown is where he was born. They caught him. These three of them are actively engaged in this, five were all engaged, whites, policemen. Harold Snayman was in charge of them. They took him to the police headquarters in Port Elizabeth, which is right on the Indian Ocean in South Africa. And they interrogated him. And they beat him. They wouldn't let him sleep. Interrogated him, you know, 24 hours in shifts. And finally he was brain damaged. And they could have taken him to the hospital in Port Elizabeth. Instead, they put his naked body, so he couldn't escape, although he was in such terrible condition, he couldn't have escaped anyway, naked in the back of a Land Rover, and drove 700 miles up to Pretoria to take him to the hospital. Of course, he was dead by the time they got him. It had an electrifying effect. In Lesotho, which is just a little tiny landlocked country in South Africa, you could just feel the reverberations. And so I was teaching there, and so when his funeral came, this is one of those memorable events, with a group of students from the National University, we drove down to King Williamstown in South Africa to the funeral. And I've never seen anything like it. Thousands of people were there. His coffin was being carried over their shoulders. Mm. There were a lot of white people who were sympathetic with Biko and what he stood for there, including, and I've lost her name for a moment, a woman who was a very active woman in Parliament. Whenever she stood up in Parliament, she was Jewish, so the Afrikaner.
Helen
Suzman. Helen Suzman, S-U-Z-M-A-N. They would shout, go back to Israel. They would shout to her. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in South Africa.
Really?
But she was wonderful, and she was there. And the family made sure she had, you know, a place of honor. Because, you know, she regularly put everything on the line. She was wonderful. There were a few people like her, Helen Suzman. And the songs were sung. You know, what happened during that period was funerals were a combination of great grief and of political will. And so the coffin held up above their heads, and all these people, it was just an amazing sight. You know, I could, you know, on the ground floor, you can't see much. You could see a lot of what was happening.
Yeah.
Hear the speeches, hear the songs, and feel the determination. And you never felt in occasions like that your life was in danger because you were white. Nothing like that. It was quite a remarkable a kind of a sense of solidarity. There, we went back to Lesotho just, you know, enchanted by what had happened. Anyway, those are two events that happened within my research. So, you know, again, the idea that research is all, you know, sort of scholarly sitting down writing notes and so forth, there's a lot of things that happen. And in fact, that's what the people, they wouldn't let me be, in storytelling sessions, they wouldn't let me be the scholar who sits back. I had to participate or I was out of there, you know, and that was wonderful. Anyway, back to Mazi Tatu. This is just an incredible story. It's in July, I think, of that year, that her husband had died of tuberculosis, and she was just coming out of her mourning period. And I went to stay with her during the last weeks of her mourning period as an act of friendship. And when her mourning period, I was going to work further north among the Zulu, when her mourning period was over, she, canny woman that she was, knew that she was going to destroy my research project. She invited me to come back the following day. She was going to tell a story I had never heard before. And she pointed out that her grandchildren were going to Western-style schools with Dickens and Emma stuck in their back pockets, no longer interested in the oral tradition. So she wanted to tell the story. She had heard the story when she was a teenager at the feet of her great aunt, had heard it in bits and pieces, told it in bits and pieces since then. She wanted to tell it once more before she died, and pointing out that her grandchildren were going to schools no longer interested in the oral tradition, she wanted me there to tape it for posterity. She also explained, so the next day, 10 o'clock in the morning, it's to begin. So she's, what, 60 years old now or something? Getting close, anyway. And in her audience were seven women and two men of her age, and then the audience waxed and waned as time went on. The story is to begin at 10 o'clock in the morning. I never heard a story begun at 10 o'clock in the morning before. The Xhosa have a tradition that if you tell stories in the daytime, you're going to grow horns, and the reason is to keep the kids from bugging the parents when the kids should be doing their chores. But storytelling, I learned, for adults takes place at all times of day or night. She explained to her audience that, mainly to me, that the oral poets and the oral historians were by and large men, and therefore they told the origins of Xhosa society from a male point of view. This ancient epic, and so this is going to be the epic that everybody told me didn't exist, dealt with the origins of Xhosa society from a woman's point of view, so her heroes are women. So, she starts to tell a story at 10 o'clock in the morning. It goes on for 4 hours. We take a break, came back in the evening, it went on for 3 more hours. The first time I ever heard a story continued into the next day. The next day it went on for 6 hours, the next day for 5 hours, and on she went. For 21 days, this woman performed one story. Now, she was a doctor, a traditional doctor, so she had to be away seeing to her patients for 4 of those days. So actually 17 of the days were performance days. When it was over, it was 150 hours long. To give you a sense of the staggering length of that story, if Homer would have created the Odyssey at a single sitting, it may have taken him 30 or 35 hours. In my word processor, where I have transcribed and translated those 17 days, each of the days averages out to around 400 pages. But that's only part of the story. That was in July. She invites us all to come back the following October for part 2 of what she considered a 3-part Xhosa epic. My Zulu research project went up in flames. There was no way I would miss this. The following October, part 2, 150 hours, and then the following January, part 3, so that the 3-part epic amounts to something like 500 hours. Incredible.
Unbelievable.
And the thing is that she had control of everything that she was doing. She did confess to me that 7 days into the beginning of this epic that she started to lose sleep because she was trying to keep everything organized in her mind. But when I transcribed and translated it and had the luxury of being able to look at it through a microscope, as it were, things do not get out of control for her. She was just amazing. And the audience loved it, and I loved it, and it was a very exciting kind of a thing. The reason we took a break, she had this, you know, the farming had to be done, she had to be seeing her patients, and she also had to catch her breath. So that's why we had this lengthy period in between each one.
But what it was just the title of that effort?
Well, one of the things that I have transcribed and translated the first part of it. And part of the first day was published in a book of mine called The Tongue is Fire. And I've been reluctant to publish the whole thing because I'm not crazy about my translation. And so I keep working with it and playing with it almost on a regular basis. The central character in the story is a woman called Michi, M-I-T-Y-I. So whatever the title is going to be, she'll be involved in it somehow. Mm-hmm. Masitatu didn't give her stories titles. So I'm not quite sure of the title. And what happens is, Michi dies during the first third of the epic, and so it takes up succeeding generations from her. So it's a very dramatic epic. Maybe doesn't have the kinds of epic battles in it, but it does have interesting battles and that and so forth. So it from an international point of view, it pretty much obeys the edicts of the epic form, I think. It's quite dramatic, and so that was just wonderful. I always felt from the very first time, as I said earlier, that I thought that she had an epic in her, but I had no idea that it was going to be of this incredible. By the way, one of the interesting things that's happened here is that she's pretty well known now in South Africa, and if I don't do anything else of any value, it will be to have called her to the attention of people.
I think you have done other things of value.
Yes, but she's quite extraordinary.
But you have identified an icon for South Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me,
yeah,
from what you're saying.
Sure. So, and that was pretty much then the last time that I really did much work with her. I spent 10 years in Africa teaching and doing research. Four of those years, a year each time, I walked up and down the southeastern coast of the continent, 1,500 miles each time.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth time was really to work with my translations and transcriptions and to actually work with people to make sure that I knew what I was doing. And the thing is, I have just finished two volumes of her, Masitatu Zeinani, and one of oral histories, and I've been working on them for years, and they're going to be published now, this is one small part of the collection. But I had the Xhosa instructor, who's from South Africa, she was in yesterday, and so I asked her just to look at a few pages in this, and I was absolutely delighted with her response. She was very pleased, and so I'm very happy about that. I don't have a lot of people now to work with. You know, when I went back there, that fourth field trip, that was really to do a lot of that, and I learned a lot during that period as well. Other times I've gone back to South Africa have been for literary purposes. I've worked in the archives in Johannesburg and in Cape Town, collecting materials on written materials as well as oral materials in southern Africa. So I have been able to sort of bridge my interest in oral traditions and literature as well during that period. So the last time I've been back was in the early 80s, and that was to do research, you know, in libraries. So the work with the oral traditions now, I've got enough material to last me three lifetimes. You know, I'll never go through all that material. Now that it's digitized by the library, and a copy of this by mutual consent will be sent to the University of Cape Town Libraries. By the way, one of the things that happened to me, I could, you know, I first of all, I never wanted to pay people for what I was doing.
Right.
And the second thing, I could never have paid them anyway, what all this was worth. So I made a deal with them. And that is, if they allowed me to attend these storytelling sessions and tape them and so forth, that when freedom came to South Africa, that a copy of their work would go back to South Africa and would be available for future generations. And they, so it was a collaborative effort. And so we signed a contract with the library, and part of the contract is that a full copy of all of this will go to the University of Cape Town when it's complete. And the University of Cape Town libraries. And the libraries are very pleased about this. So the stuff will be around for future generations. And, you know, it's not the last word in oral traditions, but it is the last word for that particular period of time. I think that I got enough material to sort of characterize this as, this is the state of the oral traditions, at least in this part of Africa, at this particular time in history.
Do you sometimes sit amazed or astounded at the scholar you are, what you are doing, what your legacy is going to be? Did you ever envision leaving a significant legacy?
I think that not at the beginning. And, you know, when I started, I wasn't, as I told you, I wasn't sure what on earth was going to happen.
Right.
But by the time the first trip is finished and I'm moving into the second, I'm feeling more and more that I really have something that's going to be useful to people in the future. And this added another dimension to what I was doing. It came a bit late because I was a bit modest initially about what was going to happen. There's no question in my mind that I've written something like 15 books now on various subjects. These will pass. What will not pass is these stories. They're going to live. So the thing is, I think that that my major legacy is going to be this collection of stories. And I'm very proud of that. I've written about the stories. Some of the things may last, some of the things may not last, but the stories will. I have no doubt that in 200 years and beyond, the stories are going to be very, very important. And that's why it's important to me that really splendid libraries, like Memorial Library here and the University of Cape Town Library, that they have control of these things. I feel very comfortable, you know, that with this. And this is something I'm so happy with Ken Fraser, because he has this far-sighted kind of an idea. When I first came here, the library was very reticent about getting into oral materials. In fact, I was told to send the stuff down to Indiana University, which has the Folklore Institute down there. But I never did that. So I'm glad I didn't, because when I talked to Ken Fraser maybe 3 years ago about this, he was very interested in this. And, you know, he's a person who has a very broad view of, and importantly so, of what libraries do. So this is important, and then the publication of the transcriptions is also important. So, yeah, you know, I've enjoyed, you know, there's no question but that the adventurous part of my career has been collecting the material. It was so exciting. Not just the collection, which was a wonderful experience in itself and all the wonderful people I met, but as I told you, you know, sort of woven into that with the realities of the history of that country. So everything has been that in my whole life. You know, I'm going to school, but while I'm going to school, other things are happening, and they get woven into this. And there haven't, as I think back on my life and my career, I don't think there have been very many quiescent moments, you know, serene moments. They've always been moments pumped with enormous amount of activity, and I like that.
That seems to have been a conscious choice. For instance, when you're back here working on your PhD and becoming engaged in the anti-Vietnam War protest, you didn't have to do that. You could have stayed in the library,
right,
so to speak.
That's right.
But you chose not to. And as I look at it, as I listen to what you said about Valpo, or even growing up in Gary, or being out at UCLA and Watts, you seem to have made a conscious choice to pursue your scholarly life intermingled with the larger life of the world.
That's right. I could never avoid what was happening outside. I'm a news freak. Every evening I watch the BBC News, I watch, Peter Jennings or ABC or NBC. I watch the Lehrer News Hour. I read voraciously. I'm really interested in what's happening. That's been a part of my life forever. That level, and then I also the reading of literature and poetry and things like that. That excites me. I get excited about reading about the history of Constantinople and that sort of thing. So yeah, I think there is an I've been able to focus in my life, but I also have this eclectic kind of an idea that I really want to get a sense of the wholeness of this thing. And I'm not sure that I've ever really found it, but I think that I have discerned some connections between various things. I think in the later part of my career and my life, I think that this is part of that idea that my life has become more a life of the mind now, and I think that I am in the process of lacing these things together for better or for worse. I'm very much at home walking the streets of Madison. I could be walking the streets of London. I love big cities. When I went to, I didn't mention this to you, Bob, but when I was in Africa, one of my favorite cities on earth, if not the favorite city on earth, is Cairo. And when when I was in Uganda, and it was still possible in those days to take the car ferry up from the headwaters of the Nile River into the Sudan. You get out, and the Nile becomes sort of glutted with something called the Sud, S-U-D-D, which is a plant life that makes it impossible to navigate it.
Oh.
You have to get off the boat, take a train or a bus around the Nile, and then pick it up and continue going north. Went to the Sudan, went into Egypt, and two remarkable things I remember about Egypt. One of them is Cairo. I just love big cities. And Cairo is a city that you can never get tired of, because it's different every time, every street you go in. I just love it. The other experience is, I didn't mention this, but in central Egypt, when I went back, or when I was going up the Nile, leaving Uganda,